And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast, with a mission to bring the most interesting, informative, inspirational people on the planet directly to your earbuds. Of course, you can listen to the podcast, and we have done so many of them on the web at equip.org. But you can also take an action step by going to iTunes and giving us a 5-star rating. We have been receiving an avalanche of 5-star ratings, and as a result, the podcast is becoming ever more popular. You can also share the podcast with family members, friends, people within your sphere of influence. And do remember, as I go through the podcast today, that the resources that I talk about and we discuss during the podcast, you can find on the web at equip.org. Today, a special treat. I'm going to have a conversation with Dr. Jay Richards. He is a executive director of The Stream. He's a assistant research professor in the School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America and a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. He has authored so many books that I quite frankly have an addiction to, including a book that I absolutely loved titled Money, Greed, and God. Also, a book that Jay co-authored titled The Privileged Planet. He co-authored this with astronomer Guillermo Gonzalez, and he also co-authored a book with Jonathan Witt, The Hobbit Party. Jay's most recent book is The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. Jay holds a PhD with honors in philosophy and theology from Princeton Theological Seminary, and he's an all-around great guy. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Hank. Great to be with you.
It is so fun to have you on the podcast. I just love your work.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I really do appreciate it. In fact, I was just with the lieutenant governor of your state in North Carolina, actually talking to him about some of these things just before I got on with you.
Well, cool. Hey, you know, one of the things that I really want to talk to you about today is an article that you wrote. I call it an incredible 12-step program. A 12-step program for those predisposed to uncritically buying into this whole notion of scientific consensus. The title of the article, of course, you made up the title, Politics Disguised as Science, and When to Doubt a Scientific Consensus. And I kind of want to start our conversation with that, going through this 12-step program, because I think this is one of the most important articles I've ever read, particularly in today's climate. And it's a necessary 12-step program for all of us, because we are sort of coerced into believing in evolution as a scientific consensus, or climate change, or the myth of the Andalusian paradise, or growing movement towards consensus in the field of artificial intelligence. So I think it's really important for people to get this 12-step program in their minds. And quite frankly, after I saw it, I practically memorized it. I think it's that good. I think it's that important. The first thing that you came up with in terms of when to doubt a scientific consensus is when the consensus claims get bundled together. So you have a whole bunch of claims that get bundled together, and you buy into uncritically wheat that is mixed with chaff.
No, that's right. And that's always the dilemma. I use climate change as the kind of example, essentially, in the article, but it could, as you said, you can apply this to Darwinism, you can apply it to really any intellectual orthodoxy. And people that aren't specialists, I mean, none of us can be specialists in every scientific question. So how do we decide, well, okay, I'm not a specialist, or the ways I can look at this issue and decide whether the consensus that supposedly exists is the result of these people looking at the evidence, or is it groupthink? And I said that the kind of first example of this is when it's an issue that really is about separate questions, but they get bundled together. So with climate change, you've got, you know, several different questions. Is it happening, for instance? Is the globe warming, depending on the baseline? Are we causing it? Is it bad or good? That's a relevant question. And then with the policies that we might want to propose, would they make any difference? That is, what to do about it? Those are all separate questions. You might think we're in a warming trend, but say, oh, I don't know what the cause is, and it seems like it's going to be a good thing, and we don't know what the policies are. So when people ask you if you believe in climate change, they're really wanting to know whether you sign on to all of those things, but those are logically distinct. I mean, the polar ice caps could be melting, the polar bears could be drowning. That still wouldn't tell you what the cause of it is or whether any particular policy would make any difference.
We hear so much about CO2 emissions, and it's always in a negative way. We've heard that drumbeat for so long that I suppose people uncritically buy into CO2, got to be bad. Is that necessarily true?
No, not at all. I mean, it's a natural compound. It's a three-atom molecule that is produced when we respire. We breathe in, and our body takes some oxygen, and it passes out some carbon dioxide. And then plants, they effectively breathe in the carbon dioxide and release oxygen. It's an amazingly designed and interconnected system. CO2 isn't a pollutant in the same way that, say, lead or sulfur in the air can be a pollutant. It only gets treated as the bad guy because it's presumed not only that it can contribute to a greenhouse effect, which nobody doubts that. We know that carbon dioxide, you can test this in a lab, can capture infrared radiation. The question is whether the climate's so sensitive that if you just change the CO2 in the atmosphere a little bit, you end up with this cascading event of extreme weather and extreme temperature increase. That's where the debate is. But it's only because we connect it with that idea that anyone imagines that it's somehow a pollutant. But, just in terms of simple chemistry, it's one of these naturally produced compounds in the Earth's atmosphere because of life being here. And it might be good in some cases and bad in other cases, but it shouldn't be treated as if it's a pollutant.
Is there a connection between CO2 emissions and the greening of the planet?
There is, actually. And in fact, you can look at a couple of articles I often talk about that have actually both published in 2010 that looked at what's called the Leaf Area Index. And so you can sort of picture satellites taking pictures of the Earth and then analyzing the change essentially of the color. Like, okay, how much leaf area has there been in terms of change? And what we found is that from 1981 until 2010, when these studies were done, we had increased the Leaf Area Index of the planet by about 14%. And most scientists think that's primarily the result of so-called aerial fertilization. So in other words, we know from lots and lots of experiments that for different plants respond differently. But basically, if you increase the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it's a way of fertilizing the plants. And some plants respond very well to this. And so it's really kind of basic common sense in botany that if we increase the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that's going to have a positive effect on plant growth. And this is important because this happened at the same time that the rainforest in Brazil were shrinking because of humans, tearing stuff down and building farms. So even when you take that into account, we still have about basically 14% more green space since 1981 as a result of this increase in carbon dioxide.
And it seems to me that you also would have a longer growing season, and as a result of that, you'd have more food. There are a lot of people starving, so even that could be considered a good thing.
Absolutely. I mean, even in terms of you just think about warming, when it's slightly warmer, obviously this is what happened during the medieval warming period 1,000 years ago in Europe. It's when our ancestors, the Vikings, they colonized Iceland and Greenland. Well, the reason they did that is because it was a lot warmer and greener then. We know Northern Europe had better growing seasons. And so that's the reality. If you're going to say, well, is this good or bad? First of all, we need to know whether we're going toward or away from the optimum global temperature, and we don't actually know what that is. But secondly, we know there's at least two effects. Increase in carbon dioxide and at least moderate warming is very likely to be good rather than bad with respect to agriculture.
What's really interesting about this is I mentioned the myth of the Andalusian paradise, and I wrote about that in a book called Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. And I there quote Dario Fernandez Moreira, who talks about why people buy into myths like this or what the motivations are. And he gives a bunch of reasons. And perhaps I've done this actually with him on a podcast, but I think it'd be fun to get your take on it. He talks, for example, about stakeholder interests. And he says that stakeholder interests and incentives affect the research of academics in the humanities no less and perhaps even more than those in the sciences.
That is exactly true. I mean, people ask me, well, is this just some kind of conspiracy where people are getting together and they know they're lying? So no, you really don't need that to explain it. You can explain almost everything that's happening with climate research in terms of the funding incentives. I have a friend who's a biologist, and her specialty is sea urchins, and she kept trying to get the National Science Foundation to fund her research. They kept turning her down, and she figured out a way to connect her research to the hypothesis of climate change. So she framed it in that way. Guess what happened? She immediately got funded. There is no end to funding resources if you're willing to sort of buy into the intellectual orthodoxy. If, on the other hand, you want to say, well, let's compare the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the temperature across geological time and see what we come up with and treat this as a testable hypothesis, you're likely to be considered a crank. And so that's the problem. There's just that kind of incentive. And so even though you get scientists in the know that will admit, okay, yeah, there's a lot of questions about this, when it comes to the funding, that's just going to govern the way things go. It's not just true climate science. It's true in nutrition science, unfortunately. You get these nutrition organizations that are funded almost entirely by certain food lobbies, and it turns out their research almost always supports whatever the food lobby is. It doesn't mean people are lying. It's just something you call theory-induced blindness, that if you sort of believe the theory and you have every incentive to believe it, that colors your perspective on the evidence, unfortunately.
So I went back to eating eggs in the morning. That's okay.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In fact, completely forget almost everything you've been told about fat. Don't worry about it.
You know, the other thing that Dario talks about is motivated blindness, which inhibits an individual's ability to perceive what he calls inconvenient data.
Yes, absolutely. And that certainly is the case when it comes to climate science. I mean, you know, the famous dendrochronologist Michael Mann, he's the guy that became famous or infamous for the so-called hockey stick diagram that played a key role in the UN report in 2001. And it purported to show that we were in the process of this really unprecedented exponential increase in temperature. But then when they looked at the data, I mean, he's a dendrochronologist, which means, Hank, that he studies, he's trying to calculate past climate based upon tree rings. That's what the dendro refers to. And so he was arguing that, you know, because of course tree rings do respond to temperature and things like that. And so he had posited that, in fact, we're in this very unusual warming period. But then when people went back and looked at his data, it turns out he had cherry-picked, so he picked the particular pine trees that fit what he was expecting, and he had some excuse for excluding from the sample every data point in his own data that contradicted it. Now, I don't think he was consciously saying, okay, I need to lie. I think he was so convinced of the theory. He was looking for the evidence for the theory, and so he was able to come up with rationalizations that didn't become obvious to anyone looking at it from the outside, because it's exactly what you don't want to do as a scientist. You want to look at the data set and test your theory against the data set. You don't decide the theory's true ahead of time and then prune the data set to fit the theory. And so as a result, in 2007, the UN dropped that study unceremoniously. Mann is still defending it, but pretty much everyone in the know knows that now that data was sort of useless.
Something else I ran into really early this morning when I was reading the newspaper, I was reading National Review, and it reminded me of shoddy research by research professors that gets repeated by journalists. And so there's an article, it was by Jack Crow, titled "Two Researchers Have Been Forced to Issue a Major Correction to a Recent Study Indicating Oceans Have Been Warming at a Significantly Higher Rate Than Previously Thought Due to Climate Change." Interesting, because you get this kind of shoddy research, and then it gets perpetuated in the magazines and the newspapers, etc., and it becomes part of the sort of universal consciousness.
It does. I mean, it's like this number everybody's heard, 97% of scientists support catastrophic climate change. Well, you look at the details, and the study doesn't show anything like that. But honestly, it's like the whole population has that 97% number burned in the neural pathways in their brains, you know, and so it just sticks. It's the same thing with these, you know, these predictions that the New York Times, of course, trumpets when, well, it's unprecedented warming of the ocean. And then when it's retracted, you know, it might end up on page A33 and nobody hears about it, unfortunately.
Yeah, and there's also this problem of selling a cultural agenda that we ought to be wary of.
Absolutely. I mean, that's unfortunately separating the worldview chaff from the empirical wheat, as you mentioned a minute ago. That's really important when it comes to any kind of environmental debate, because very often you're dealing with people that have fundamentally different views about what it means to be human. I mean, if you're a Christian, you believe, yeah, we can mess things up. We have to consume, and we can despoil the earth and pollute it. But we're also creators of value. We're creatures made in the image of the creative God. And so there's, you know, we can be the problem, but we can also be the solution. But if you think, well, we're just basically parasites or cockroaches, and everything we do is bad. Anything we do to change the natural environment must be bad. Well, if you think that, pretty much anything we do to affect the environment is going to be treated as if it's some kind of violation of the law of nature. And so that's why you have some kind of radicals in the so-called deep ecology movement that really, I mean, their ideal would be a planet without any human impact at all. I'm not saying all environmentalists think this. That's certainly not true. But that is a dark strain, unfortunately, in the environmental movement. So you always have to sort of negotiate that. Okay, what does the evidence say? And or is this really someone's axe to grind just against humanity in general?
Talk a little bit, Jay, about the problem of having your eye on the wrong ball. What I mean by that, and this is something I've heard you discuss in the past, let's say climate change. If we have our eye on the wrong ball, if we spend tens of trillions of dollars of the global economy on the wrong problem, it has an attendant effect in that there are all kinds of other problems that don't get solved. Fresh water for everyone on the planet that doesn't presently have fresh water, for example.
That's right. I mean, that's just, you know, simple economics of opportunity costs. Is that if you do one thing, it's going to exclude you from doing something else. If we spend, say, you know, the Paris Climate Accords, which countries voluntarily sign on to, where they pledge to try to reduce their use of carbon dioxide producing fuels for energy, let's say everybody does that. Well, the official estimates is that would cost about $1 to $2 trillion a year to the global economy. That's $1 or $2 trillion that's not being spent on something else, like economic development in the third world, where people, the most important thing that could happen to them is to increase their per capita income, because then they'll be more adaptable. Or as you said, fitting the rest of the world that doesn't have it with water sanitation equipment and technology. Most of those things would cost a fraction of the cost of these Paris climate protocols. And it turns out the official estimates from the UN is that even if all the countries actually signed on to the Paris Agreement, implemented it fully, it would have essentially a negligible effect on the warming of the planet between now and 2100. So it's a sort of all pain and no gain scenario, which doesn't make any logical sense.
I want to get back to the 12 reasons that you raise in terms of what we ought to question when it comes to the notion of consensus, whatever the subject. The second reason that I remember in your list of 12 is ad hominem attacks. And the one that I remember the most with respect to climate change was Alan Goodman of the Boston Globe, who said that we're at a point where global warming is impossible to deny. Let's just say that global warming deniers are now on par with Holocaust deniers. Now, there are a couple of things involved here. Part of the problem is the terminology that is used. I mean,
yes.
You're not denying that the globe is warming.
No, not at all. Yeah, that's the problem. Of course, there's that. There's no denial of that. And then just the very use of the word denier, which is associated with Holocaust denial. And so they managed to tar you in two or three different ways simply by invoking that particular word. That's, unfortunately, I think that's the way this goes. We had a conference here at Catholic University a few years ago at the request of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. They just kind of wanted a briefing on the climate issue. And so I talked about the science, and there was another fellow that was on the panel who's also a believing Christian. And I kind of gave my 15-minute summary of the evidence. And then he did not respond to any of my scientific points. He just said that he knew that most people that took my position were really secretly funded by the oil industry and suspected that that played some role in my views on this. Well, I have to say, I'd be happy to be funded by the oil industry if anyone wanted to send me a check. But it had nothing to do with that. And, of course, it was a mistake on his part, because he was on a university campus with philosophers in the audience. And one of my colleagues said, wait, are you saying that Jay's views are determined by funding from oil companies? Is that really what you argued? But see, this is kind of reflexive, unfortunately, because people don't want to talk about the nuts and bolts. It's almost like if you get them talking about the science, they feel like you've gotten them off track. They assume that if you disagree with them, it must be the result of bad faith. It must be the result of some evil motive. You can't possibly just look at the evidence and come out differently on the interpretation.
So what about that? I mean, how do you get people to think critically? I was listening to some political debates during the midterms, and you have people on either side throwing out these canards, and it's very, very hard unless you have a critical thinking process in place to figure out whether something that is being said really has any weight or it doesn't have any weight. And there's just so much nonsense that's being put into the stream. You hardly know where to begin if you don't know how to think critically.
No, that's the dilemma. And so I will very often, when I get these kind of ad hominem attacks and people want to sort of distract it, sometimes concede it. I'll say, okay, look, actually, I'd have never gotten any funding from any oil company, but let's assume that I have. That's still not going to change the logical point. If I'm saying, whether something is happening and what's causing that thing to happen, that's a logical point. You don't have to trust me. Once you realize whether the Earth is warming and what's causing the Earth to warm, that's just a logical distinction that once it's pointed out, even if I'm a greedy guy that really wants to pull the wool over everybody's eyes, the point still stands. It's not like the cause of something and that something itself become the same because I'm being funded by the oil company. That's the problem. These ad hominem arguments very rarely rarely bear on the issue at hand. And so you're constantly having to sort of appeal to people's kind of mother wit and common sense to see these things.
Well, you actually make a point of this, and I think it's your third point, where you talk about scientists who are pressured to toe the party line, which is huge with respect to tenure and job promotions, grants, media accolades, and, you know, vanity. All of these things are actually a factor.
Yeah, they absolutely are. I mean, we have this mythological idea of the natural scientist as this sort of transcendent being that doesn't have any particular motives, doesn't have any, is not susceptible to social pressure, that's just this totally objective being.
Sort of wearing a white lab coat.
Yes, always wearing a white lab coat and sort of floating above the fray. But scientists are human beings. And so the ideal of science is that you'd be objective and test the theory against the evidence. But in reality, scientists they're just susceptible to groupthink. They're just as susceptible to attacking the person with an unpopular opinion as the rest of them. And so the question is, when you see this happening in a scientific dispute, for instance, if you notice that there will be prominent scientists that will start to come out against the intellectual orthodoxy late in their careers or right after they retire, that tells you something. So in other words, they realize, okay, I got to keep my head down while I'm still a professor. I may be tenured, but, you know, I could be done for if I talk about this. But then they'll retire, and suddenly they start breathing fire on this issue. That is a telltale sign that there's some kind of intellectual orthodoxy being enforced in the discipline, so that only people that enjoy some kind of independence are willing to speak out. And you see that over and over again in the climate science literature. Elderly, prominent scientists will get bold just after they've retired from full-time teaching.
One of my son-in-laws is a philosophy professor at the Air Force Academy, and when I have him on the Bible Answer Man broadcast, he has to make all kinds of qualifications just because of where he works, because if he doesn't make those qualifications and make absolutely clear that this does not represent the Air Force Academy, this represents his opinion, if he doesn't make those qualifications, his job is at risk.
That doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, in some ways, I benefit from the fact that I'm a philosopher. I mean, at the business school here, but I'm still a philosopher, and it's sort of the job of philosophers to talk about controversial topics and to make arguments. But, you know, if you're in the sciences or you're working for a government agency or a government institution, there's a lot less academic freedom and just freedom to be able to debate really important issues than there are just out on the street at random or in a random bar. I mean, people that aren't in the academy don't realize just how restrictive it can be and how nobody has to tell you, well, you could get in trouble if you talk about that. You don't have to be told that. You can kind of read the tea leaves. You can feel it in the air. You can tell that there are just certain things that you're not supposed to talk about or you're not supposed to raise, and it would just be best if we don't discuss that issue.
I think you need to write a book on this, quite frankly. I mean, take those 12 points and make it a 12-step program. You could be clever with it, but I mean, I think this discussion is just so transcendently important. I couldn't wait to have it with you. You, for example, say that you ought to be skeptical when publishing and peer review becomes cliquish.
Yes, this is such a problem in the natural sciences, and some listeners may remember back in 2009 with the so-called ClimateGate scandal, in which a bunch of documents, thousands of emails and reports and things were leaked from a lab in the UK that was a climate change lab. And when people read the emails, it turns out some of these scientists, like Michael Mann and different people, they were conspiring, quite literally, the guys that are editors of climate journals. And they would be saying, okay, we're going to destroy this editor if he allows this one piece that we disagree with to be published. It was just the kind of thing that, you know, only you almost have to be a kind of conspiratorially minded person to think this is happening. But it's exactly what was happening. And so if you look at, you know, the sort of family tree of the peer-reviewed literature when it comes to climate science, you discover that it's the same four or five or six people, all of whom have an axe to grind, that are on the editorial boards of different journals. And then if another journal decides to be independent and publish the controversy and entertain the debate, then they'll get blackballed by a bunch of the influential people in the area. This, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, this was easier to do than it is now. And the reason is because there are a lot of online journals. There's a Twitter feed that I follow that basically shows all the bad stuff that gets through peer review, so that if this kind of thing happens, it tends to be publicized. So if you're somebody like me that really follows this, you can get the information very easily. It's just that most people's understanding of the climate issue is not much deeper than what they happen to see on the front page of magazines when they're walking through the airport. And at that level, you're never going to be exposed to any of these underlying controversies.
That's really scary, because when I was listening to those debates that I alluded to earlier, I mean, I heard dogmatic assertions which simply did not correspond to reality by key politicians. And so it's kind of frightening when you think about the people governing the land, legislating. They don't really understand the issues at all. They only understand the narrative.
No, that's right. I mean, in some ways, we can't expect politicians, you know, in Washington, for instance, they're busy people. They don't have time to focus on this. Nevertheless, they get briefed. I do this frequently in Washington, D.C. You'll get asked to come brief a politician on some issues so that they say, okay, what do I need to understand about this? So when it comes to climate change, people could be responsible. They wouldn't have to pretend to be experts. But so much of this, at least in the political sphere, is about virtue signaling. And so even if you know, well, the details are actually more complicated than this, but I can benefit in votes in terms of my constituency by exaggerating or misrepresenting the details. And so, unfortunately, you know, this has been happening for decades. Al Gore, in some ways, parlayed this into an art form in terms of being able to use this issue for demagoguery. But my view is, look, if you're really interested in the environment, then you should be interested enough to care about what the science actually says, so that if we need to do something about it, we do the right thing rather than the wrong thing.
I hear so many people today talking about the fires in California being a function of climate change. How do we process that?
Well, it's a prediction of the theory that if unprecedented warming will occur, then certain climate extremes will result from that, whether it be increased droughts, increased intensity and frequency of hurricanes, things like this. What most people don't realize is these are predictions of a theory once you get unprecedented warming. But of course, at the moment, it's no warmer now than it was 1,000 years ago. And if you actually look at the data, which there's hurricane scientists that look at this, there's no increase in droughts. There's absolutely no trend whatsoever in the 20th century in terms of frequency or intensity of hurricane. And in fact, the climate change catastrophists will be the first people to tell you, if it's, say, cold outside, like it is in Washington, D.C. today, that weather is not climate. But then, of course, if you have a hot spell or you have fires like you do in California, suddenly weather is climate. It's proof of climate change and global warming. The truth of the matter is that hurricanes do happen, and you're going to get some, you know, not big ones, and you're going to get bad ones every so often. and fires happen in California. It's a very dry Mediterranean desert climate that also has kind of some bad policies that I think contribute to this. But whenever you get an event like this, it's really a prediction of what will happen if it actually warms. By definition, since we haven't had this huge amount of warming, we can't have these things happening. And so they can't be citing these as evidence, at least not yet. It's one thing to say this stuff will happen if the warming continues. It's another thing to say, oh, okay, see, here's one example of this thing happening. It must be being caused by the warming. It just doesn't follow.
Well, something else that may not follow, and I'd be interested in your observations on this, are hurricanes naturally bad? I mean, in other words, it seems to me that there are many benefits to hurricanes. It also seems to me that the real problem is not the hurricane, but the fact that we're building in areas where hurricanes hit, and because they're sort of a global pot, if in fact there's a catastrophe, you're going to get bailed out. So you keep building in those areas.
Yes. That's a huge problem, and no one really likes to talk about this, but you know, we get massive property damage in part because we put really valuable property right on the ocean. And as you said, there's a kind of a perverse incentive here. If I build something next to the ocean and I'm going to have to bear the entire risk if the thing gets destroyed and I can't get insurance because of the risk, I'm going to make a different decision than if I build this and I can't get insurance. But that's okay, because if it gets destroyed, I'll get FEMA money from the federal government that will cover it. Remember, John Stossel did a terrific report on this a few years ago, and he was one of these people. He said, look, I did this. I built a house by the ocean and ended up getting damaged, and that's a perfectly rational thing to do if you know somebody else is bearing the risk. But the truth of the matter is, if we build valuable stuff right next to the ocean in places where hurricanes happen periodically, it's going to follow by iron rails of logic that once in a while that stuff's going to get destroyed and there's going to be a lot of property damage.
Seems like even fires have an attendant benefit.
Well, certainly fires are a part of the kind of natural carbon cycle. I mean, certainly there are places, you know, farmers do this, in which sometimes they'll burn hay on their field in order to increase certain elements and properties in the soil. And so it's a natural part of the way God created the world. But of course, if we build, on the one hand, nice neighborhoods in places that are very dry and that are prone to fire, and then you implement water policies and policies in terms of, you know, how you can husband the land and what plants you can cut down and things like that. In other words, if we do lots of things both to expose ourselves to fire and to encourage policies that make it more likely you're going to have a fire, that's going to happen whatever is happening in the overall climate. And so I really think we should, the problem is if we blame all this stuff on, you know, this big bad climate change, we don't actually focus on the policies that might actually make a difference in these catastrophes that do happen.
You better watch what you're saying, or there's going to be an entry on you on Wikipedia.
And I have no control over my Wikipedia page, so I gave up on that a long time ago.
What about early snowfalls? I mean, even early snowfalls seem to be spun around as being a function of climate change.
That's right. I mean, and this is the sort of charm of the theory, because if you can predict that any extreme weather event is the result of global warming, that's what climate change refers to. It's like extreme weather events as a result of the warming, then even cooling or early snowstorms end up being evidence for the theory. And so you realize, okay, wait, if everything that's opposite can be evidence for a theory, that basically makes the theory untestable. So if you make risky predictions, for instance, you project, okay, there's going to be this amount of warming. This is what we predict we'll see. Now let's look at the satellite data 10 years from now. And then you look and there's not as much warming, and you say, okay, well, that disconfirms my prediction. That's honest science. If you suddenly say, well, we must have misunderstood how to make the prediction, let us rework the variables, you've basically made your theory immune to falsification or to testing from the evidence. That's not how natural science is supposed to work.
You talk about the peer review process as one of your points, and make the point that dissenters are often excluded, and that, in some great sense, invalidates the process to begin with, I would think.
That's right. I mean, the whole point of peer review is that it's supposed to be double-blind, supposed to be dispassionate, so that people are just evaluating, say, experimental protocols that are set up or the testing. Ideally, you'd want it to be something that could be repeated in another lab or with another experiment. That's what peer review is supposed to do. And when it works well, that's what it is. Unfortunately, in a lot of these highly specialized journals, they're highly cliquish. And so even if it's you know, double blind so that officially you don't see the name of the author. Peer reviewers, they know exactly who this is. And I have stories of friends that I know who are in climate science that do this, and they're constantly trying to figure out, okay, how do we publish this and submit this for publication in a way that they don't figure out that we're the author because we're going to get blackballed. And then they do manage to get something through peer review. It comes out, and then they're attacked. And I know this one fellow at Harvard that after his article came out, he was attacked, and his critics tried to get his funding pulled from it. So on the one side, you get prevented from getting the stuff published. And then when you do manage to get something published, you get punished for that, for making the public argument. It's really very difficult. I don't think this prevents the debate long term, but it certainly stifles it in the short term.
Yeah, agenda-driven science is in view as well when you have actual peer-reviewed literature that's being misrepresented or completely excluded. People just don't acknowledge it.
No, that's right. I mean, because that's the funny thing. Even though there's so many sort of difficulties with the peer review process, there's lots and lots of peer-reviewed data and articles with data in them that suggest that, look, you know, at least with respect to climate sensitivity, there's just a heck of a lot of stuff we don't know, and there's a legitimate scientific debate. But it's complicated. I mean, people don't know the difference between the sensitivity of the climate to CO2 and the climate feedbacks that can either enhance the effects or mitigate and dampen down the effects. It's kind of complicated. And so people don't kind of get what the debate is about. They're not going to know the diversity of the peer review literature itself. And so even though you could go on AstroPH, which is this kind of archive site, and see all the science journals that are published, most people don't know how to do that. They wouldn't know how to read the papers. And so they rely on science journalists very often. These are journalist majors that maybe be 27 years old and not even know the science themselves, but they end up mediating the information that's actually in the literature for the general public. And unfortunately, they very often scramble the interpretation process.
I love your seventh point for a lot of reasons. Number one, it was easy to remember because seven is the number of perfection. And this is your seventh of the 12-step program. And that's where you talk about consensus being declared before consensus even exists. And you give, I believe, Al Gore is a classic case in point.
He is. I mean, that's what's funny, because I've been following Al Gore on this since about 1989. I looked this up because I thought, wait, because I remember later, just in the last few years or so, he was saying, well, now, you know, now there's a consensus. There used to be a debate about it back in the 90s, but now there's no longer a consensus. But if you look at what Al Gore said way back in 1992, here's what he said. He said, only an insignificant fraction of scientists deny the global warming crisis. The time for debate is over. The science is settled. This is what he was telling us. But then much later, he was saying, well, no, there used to be a debate about it back in the 90s, but now there's absolutely a consensus. And in fact, if you looked at the real debate, the Gallup in 1992 actually did a poll of scientists, and 53% of the scientists actively involved in global climate research either didn't believe global warming had occurred, 30% weren't sure, and only 17% believed global warming in the sense of human-caused global warming had even begun. And that makes perfect sense, because the reality is, if you look at the average global temperature going back over 1,000 years or 2,000 years, there's a huge amount of variation. And so the fact that we might be in a warming trend right now, it's no more significant than the warming trend 1,000 years ago. And so what that means is that the signal gets swamped by the noise. The noise is this natural variation. And so you need to be able to say, okay, so which part of the variation and the increase that's happening right now is actually the result of the human activities as opposed to just the result of whatever the natural fluctuation is. And so, again, it's another logical point. It's very hard to separate the signal from the noise when it comes to these things. And so it makes sense that in 92, for sure, scientists would say, well, we don't know. We might have our suspicions, but, you know, we certainly can't be sure about this.
Help us understand as well the distinction between real data as opposed to data that you get from consensus scientists who are interpreting the data.
Well, this is always the difficult thing when it comes to natural science, because we understand the difference between, you know, my theory for what this star ought to be composed of and my observation from spectral analysis of what it's actually composed of. And then, but when you get to climate science, the data is always complicated, because it's not a matter of, we can't just stick a thermometer in the earth and say, okay, what's its temperature? We have to do complicated things with satellite readings or, you know, upper altitude hot air balloons in the upper part of the atmosphere, or thousands of ground-based satellites, which are ground-based, basically temperature reading sites where the conditions can change over time and you have to then adjust to account for all those changes. And so when, because there's so much of the data is mediated by human interpretation, very often even the data itself will become contaminated by the interpretation. Many of your listeners may have heard about how this happens with these ground-based satellites, is that if you look at the raw data, it will show one thing, but then you look at the official data and turns out it always shows increased warming. This is, again, it's kind of the expectations of the theoretician. So if the data doesn't, you know, if it doesn't quite say what they were expecting, then they readjust it to cause it to say what they were expecting. Again, I don't think this is the result of lying. I think it's the result of this theory-induced blindness. And so I really always try to focus on the data that's the easiest to nail down and that's most likely to be objective. So, for instance, the data from these upper atmosphere hot air balloons the satellite data, for instance, which is not susceptible to the contamination of these ground-based measurements, I tend to rely on those. So I want to know, okay, what does the satellite data tell us about this warming trend? Let's compare it to the ground-based satellites. But if there's a conflict, we should often favor the satellites over the ground-based stuff, just because, one, it's more reliable, and two, it's less susceptible to this human interpretation and adjusting that often goes on.
I heard a scientist in some venue, I can't remember where exactly, talking about the different global models or different models from different countries. And I think he was saying there's something like 32 or 33 of them, and they're all in harmony except for one, and that is the Russia model.
That's very interesting. Well, I know that the largest total is about 99 of these models, but there are probably about 44 that are very prevalent, and people can actually find this called the spaghetti graph is often what it's called in the literature. But it's essentially, okay, what do the models predict? And so you look at this thing, and it's sort of the date along the x-axis and the temperature along the y-axis. And you look at what these different models predict, and they're all over the place, going up and down. But virtually all of them predict increased warming. As you said, there may be one or two. I wouldn't be surprised if it was the Russian one that predicts something else. But then you overlay the data that I talked about a minute ago. So the satellite data that's from the University of Alabama, Huntsville, and then this data from the upper atmosphere balloons called RSS. What you find is that the theoretical predictions all predict about twice the rate of warming that's actually being observed. So if you take all those 44 models and say, okay, what's the average of what they're predicting? They predict about twice as much warming as we're actually observing. And so that suggests that they're plugging in some variables, in particular feedback mechanisms that they're assuming are positive, which means they think the feedback amplifies the effects of the natural warming of the CO2. This suggests that either we don't know what all the feedbacks are, or some of the feedbacks are counting as positive are actually negative, which means that they would essentially help mitigate the effects of the warming. And so that's really, honestly, that's where the whole debate is. It's this question about which climate feedbacks are positive, which are negative, and maybe that they balance each other out, in which case we can just talk about the warming of the CO2 itself, which is not that significant by itself. It's the CO2 plus the feedback that is leading to all these catastrophic predictions. But, you know, I say, look, if you've got theoretical models based on assumptions and you've got observations and they can contradict each other, go with the observations and adjust your models accordingly. Don't stick with the models and ignore the observations.
I think we're around the ninth point in your 12-step program, but you say something to the effect of better watch your wallet when you hear someone say science says or scientists say. These monikers have become part of our language, but we ought to be very, very wary of them.
Absolutely. In fact, Hank, I think I've heard you talk about this. Look, you know, science is an institution. It's not an agent. It doesn't talk. It doesn't have an opinion. Scientists say things. Scientific organizations might issue press releases, but science doesn't say anything. And so very often when I hear science says, I'm always suspicious because I think, okay, well, that's a covering term to prevent me from asking the question, okay, which scientists? What's their expertise? You know, why should I believe them and not some other scientists? Because that's, on almost any really controversial debate, there are going to be some scientists that say one thing, some that say the other. That doesn't mean we should be relativists. There might be a correct answer, and some are right and some are wrong. But science says that that's the locution that you hear with respect to a subject. It's sort of one other piece of evidence that if you add that to some of these other signs of suspicion, I think you can start to feel justified in doubting the supposed consensus.
Yeah, and speaking of consensus science, you have to really worry when consensus science is being used to justify dramatic political or economic policies. And I think that's probably, again, one of the highlights of the 12-step program. It's the 10th step in your 12-step program. But again, it's a highlight because here you have consensus science used to justify economic policies that can devastate the lives of poor people all over the planet with exactly the opposite narrative that you're actually helping the poor.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, the reality is if you're really poor, whatever happens, whatever change occurs, you're the most likely one to be harmed by it because you're not able to adjust and adapt. I mean, the climate changes in your location and you're rich, you just move somewhere else. It's not that complicated. If you're in Central or South America and you've got the whole place dries up or something and you're a farmer, probably don't have a plan B. And so we really need to be careful and exercise our prudential judgment really carefully when we're thinking about these policies. But, you know, I always say, look, why is it that, you know, we don't look to the United Nations to help us figure out things in chemistry or to the United Nations to solve particular types of cancer? Why would we assume that the United Nations is going to be the go-to source of information when it comes to climate science issues? There's no reason to assume that. And then when you discover that every report that the UN gives on these issues, their only solution is always hand over more of the global economy to transnational political elites and they will somehow take care of us. That's just, you know, if the scientific debate doesn't have any big worldview implications and it has no political implication, it's much less likely to be contaminated. But when it does, when it has huge worldview and political implications and the science is used to justify big, huge, dramatic political and economic policies, again, this is just one more reason that you can be suspicious.
Yeah, related to this is the whole matter of global governance, as opposed to this new nefarious term that we're hearing over and over again, nationalism.
Yes, exactly. And the problem is the word nationalism, it's like the word liberalism and capitalism. People don't define what the word means. And so if you mean by nationalism, well, a political ideology in which we make the nation the highest good and we demonize everyone else, of course that's a bad thing. And that, in fact, that's not anything that the average American would support. But when political scientists and political theorists use nationalism, what they're referring to is just the idea that the world is better with several different nation states as opposed to a transnational political entity that somehow unifies them. And so if you read the debate right now, at least in foreign policy, and political thought, the people that are talking about nationalism, they're not talking about national socialism. They're not even talking about the French nationalism of Charles de Gaulle. What they're saying is that human beings in the world are better off when we have countries pursuing their interests and negotiating treaties in ways that matter, but we do not want to empower an unaccountable elite which could not be checked against another country. I mean, the truth of the matter is Americans are better off with America not being in charge of anything, because we're fallen creatures too. If we had too much absolute power, we would probably misuse it and lord it over people. We need to be challenged on certain things. And so when somebody says, I'm a nationalist, you want to ask them, okay, are you talking about that kind of nasty, America's great and everybody else is evil nationalism? Or are you just saying you think it's better to have nations than to have one world government? Those are two totally different issues. But notice the word nationalism is used in both cases.
So it's important that we recognize that words are not univocal, they're equivocal. They take on the meaning that the context allows them to have.
Absolutely, and especially there's words that have ism at the end are especially susceptible to equivocation. I mean, for a long time, Hank, I used the word capitalism. In fact, my Money, Greed, and God book in 2009 has capitalism in the subtitle, and I've actually changed that in the 10-year anniversary edition that comes out next year. I say its subtitle is A Christian Case for Free Enterprise, because the word capitalism was popularized by Karl Marx. I mean, it was used as a pejorative. It was intended to be a pejorative term. It's just that it stuck. And so we use the word to refer to a system of limited government and private property and economic freedom, all good things. That's one of the dictionary definitions. But I often ask students, I say, give me the mental picture of what you have when you hear the word capitalism. And more often than not, they're picturing some portly guy in a tuxedo and on Wall Street smoking a cigar. That's just the mental picture associated with the word. So you're always in these debates, you're saying, okay, is this a word I need to try to redeem and defend? Or is the word just such a mental impediment to getting the ideas across that it's better to use a less tainted and more neutral word?
You know, I didn't want to get off on this subject, but I do think it's an important one. Why do you think it is that so many young people have bought into the socialist paradigm? I remember you in one of our conversations, I don't know if it was private, but I don't think this is a private subject matter, but talking about the fact that you yourself, when you were in school, had bought into Marxism or socialism. And I wonder, is this an alarming trend, or is this just the common thing that people go through and grow out of?
I think it's frustrating to me more than anything else, because I feel like, oh gosh, are we having to have this discussion again? It's the same arguments, it's the same ill-conceived understandings of economics. But I really do think it's kind of the same old, same old. It's exactly what I, in the 80s, when I was in college, I was imbibing this stuff. And when you first hear it, it sounds nice. If you don't actually know anything about economics, it can sort of make sense. I know there was a panel here on campus last night where these students thought, let's talk about democratic socialism. Actually, my daughter and some of her friends went. And, you know, there wasn't anything new. In fact, the students admitted that they hadn't studied economics or anything. And I thought, well, it's, you know, it's good that we have these discussions. Nevertheless, we should always remember that when it comes to these issues, people have to be taught again and again in every generation. You can't just take for granted that, well, I've made that argument to people 15 years ago, so surely it's already out there. No, you constantly have to keep reiterating these points, because there's always somebody at every moment that's just coming of age, that's just becoming aware of the issue. And so you can treat that as a good or bad thing. In my case, it gives me something to do. And I realize, unfortunately, I'm never going to reach the point where it's like, okay, well, that debate is settled. But unfortunately, I don't think it will be settled until the Lord comes back.
One of the quotes that always sticks in my mind in this regard is a quote that's attributed to Ronald Reagan, that socialism only works in heaven where they don't need it, and in hell where they already have it.
Exactly. I mean, this is what's so strange, is because if you talk about socialism, I was in a debate, did a debate at American Enterprise Institute about a month ago with a prominent Christian democratic socialist that writes for the Washington Post. And I said, look, why would you want to defend socialism? Every actual socialist experiment that's actually been tried in the 20th century ended up as a human catastrophe. People will try to talk about Scandinavia as socialist, but if you ask them, they'll say, no, this isn't socialism. And in fact, we have a lot of economic freedom. Why bother to defend that? But they will say, well, no, it's never really been tried properly. Nobody says that about Nazism. Nobody says, well, it just hasn't been implemented properly. I don't know why the word socialism doesn't finally just, you know, fall into disrepute. But I think part of it's just that it has that nice word social in it, and you can count on the media to sort of keep propping it up. I mean, that's the depressing thing about this year and last year. You know, we had the 100-year anniversary last year of the Russian Revolution, and this year was Karl Marx's 200th birthday. And this big New York Times series talking about Karl Marx, and there was one article that said Karl Marx is right. I mean, this is in the New York Times. And so there's just some kind of foggy delusion that comes upon people, I think, when it comes to these issues.
I think the book Money, Greed, and God is must reading, and I want to let everybody know you can find the book on the web at equip.org, and it's always available for those who support the Christian Research Institute. You mentioned the journalists, and that's your 11th point, that consensus oftentimes is maintained and supported, and goaded on by an army of water-carrying journalists. And I'm really interested in the social dynamics of that as well. Why is it that we have so many journalists that don't seem to be able to think critically, that just go? Is it because they're lazy? I mean, what's going on?
I think it's honestly, more than anything, it's a sociological reality. For whatever reason, people that are left of center very often want to go into journalism. You'll get conservative students and they say, well, I'm going to major in finance or in mechanical engineering or something like that. For whatever reason, many people on the left part of the spectrum say, I'm going to go into journalism. They want to tell the truth. They tend not to know anything about this issue. Maybe they had one biased science course in college. And so they end up seeing it as a kind of defining element of their profession, of their vocation to do this stuff. And so I constantly ask people, okay, look, where have you gotten your information about climate science, honestly? Because 99% of the information that most of us carry around in our heads on this, we have gotten directly from journalists who themselves may have no scientific expertise and may very well have an axe to grind. And so they do play an outsized role in influencing us on these issues. And then, you know, even, you know, if you're reading National Geographic or you're reading Vanity Fair, most people don't even actually read the articles. They just see what's on the cover. And so really, it's not even the journalists that are influencing us. It's the people that write the headline copy. So they have an amazing ability to shape public perception. Every April during Earth Week and Earth Day, you'll get pictures of polar bears looking out on off of a piece of ice into the ocean. And we're supposed to, of course, interpret that as a polar bear running out of, you know, places to swim. It's probably a picture of a polar bear waiting for a seal to come up. But, you know, that's not the interpretation. And so much of what we think about this issue is entirely the result of headlines and pictures. And the pictures are interpreted by way of the headlines themselves.
I love your last point. I mean, I think this is really a very fitting last point, and that is you ought to be very skeptical about consensus science. The reason being is you never talk about a consensus. Let's say if we're talking about Big Bang cosmology, you don't talk about a consensus. But it's when you talk about, well, really, really spurious or debatable issues.
That's right. I say, you know, basically when we keep being told that there's a scientific consensus, nobody talks about the consensus of the periodic table of the elements, or somebody doubts, you know, a cosmic beginning. People, you just talk about the evidence. Let's look at the cosmic background radiation. Let's look at the redshift of the stars. Look at the distribution of the elements and cosmic nucleosynthesis. I can just go on and on talking about the evidence. It doesn't matter that, yeah, okay, 99% of physicists agree on this. That's actually not the point. It's only when you don't have a lot of those things that suddenly people want to talk about consensus. And that itself, I think that's the sort of irony, is that you say, well, should I doubt the supposed scientific consensus? I say, well, are you hearing a lot about there being a consensus on this? If so, that itself is a sign of suspicion. Now, I don't say in this list of 12 that if any one of these things obtains, then you should be skeptical. What I'm saying is the more of these things that you see building up around an issue, the more justification you have in suspecting that you're dealing not with a dispassionate conclusion of the scientific community for the evidence, but you're dealing with a kind of groupthink. And we need a mental filter to be able to do this, because we can't be experts in everything. And fortunately, there's a way we can look at the sociological dynamics around the scientific issue so that we can, I think, kind of have a rational ground to stand on, even if we don't actually have time to study dendrochronology and climate science.
Well, you know, your 12-step program for me has been a mental filter. I mean, it's really, really helped me out, just getting those points in my head on so many different issues. So thank you. You also adapted an old legal adage: when you've got solid scientific evidence on your side, well, then you argue the evidence. When you've got great arguments, you make the arguments. But when you don't have solid evidence or you don't have great arguments, then you claim consensus.
That's exactly right. And very often, the proponents of these ideas are leading with the consensus rather than with the arguments or the evidence.
I want to switch subjects real quickly on you, Jay. Mm-hmm. Theistic evolution, or what's sometimes called evolutionary creationism, it can mean different things to different people, but I want to get your take on that, because there are more and more Christians who are buying into this theistic evolutionary paradigm. What's your take on that?
Well, yeah, and it's funny because, Hank, several of us were actually down in Bogota, Colombia last week for a huge conference. Hundreds of Colombians came out for three full days of talks about this issue. And so there's a huge hunger for it. But theistic evolution, it has the problem in that the word evolution, as you know and your listeners know, means about eight different things. It might just mean change over time. It can mean that natural selection explains some things. Or it can mean this grand story of universal common ancestry, natural selection, and random genetic mutations. And the kind of intellectual pressure to believe that grand Darwinian story is so intense that very often Christians in the academy and in the natural sciences don't even take the time to look at the evidence. They just say, look, I need to find a way to accommodate this into my theology. And so rather than saying, okay, let's see what natural selection can really explain, what's the data, they say, well, I can see a way that God could have sort of shaped things and guided things along so that from one perspective it would look like it was natural science or natural selection and random variation. But behind the scenes, God is secretly guiding it. Now, could God guide a process that looks like it's random? Of course. On the other hand, that's not what Darwinists mean. When they're talking about a random process, they don't just mean that it looks random, it's really designed. I mean, it's random in the sense that it doesn't happen for a purpose. And not even God can guide an unguided process. That just doesn't make sense. And in fact, I don't think there's any good reason to think that guided genetic mutations would give you very much. I don't think you could get from one organism to the other, even with guided mutations. It's just not going to work. And so, a lot of the time I spend on this, like I'm not interested in whether you could reconcile the appearance of randomness with God's providence. I want to know whether that mechanism can actually explain what it's supposed to explain. And when you look at the details, it's really good at explaining antibiotic resistance in bacteria and the fluctuation of the thickness of finches on the Galapagos Islands, which never goes anywhere. It never explains or gives any evidence that it has the power to create new organs or new organelles or even to create new species. I just think the Darwinian mechanism has been vastly oversold because it functions as a designer substitute. And so it's a fool's game for Christians to think, well, let's figure out a way to accommodate this, then maybe the secularists will like us. Trust me, they're not going to like you. And if anything, they're going to have subtle contempt for you because you've essentially surrendered a central issue of the Christian faith, which is that the natural world testifies to the existence of a creator. Don't be cowed into denying that. Look at the real evidence and separate these things out. And I think there's a strong case to be made for, I mean, my view happens to be what I would just call progressive creation, and that God has acted definitively at different times in history, that he has this some kind of mysterious work week in which he creates. But of course, there are also natural processes and development, natural selection. It preserves populations. As it's often said, it can explain the survival of the species, but it cannot explain the arrival of the species.
Something that you said caught my attention earlier on. You were talking about how people really don't read the articles themselves, or they skim the articles, but the headlines really make the difference. And I think in the same sense with respect to evolution, they've really won the war in, well, that's a debatable subject whether or not they're winning the war. But the point is, they're really winning with the icons of evolution, because the icon becomes the argument.
It does. I mean, this is why it's so powerful when Jonathan Wells wrote that book, The Icons of Evolution. I was with him, by the way, in Columbia last week. Is it just that picture of the peppered moths on the tree trunks, or those comparisons of vertebrate embryos, which purport to show that early in the developmental stage of embryonic development, all these organisms look like they're exactly alike, and it's supposed to recapitulate the kind of evolutionary history of these beings. Anybody that knows the biology knows that in that case, the Haeckel's embryos, these were actually fraudulent. In the case of the peppered moths, at best, all it would show is that natural selection can work to select different members of a population based on its survival benefits. But it turns out even in that case, the moths normally don't rest on tree trunks, and we're not even clear if that was a good example of natural selection. They're just, it's amazing how little natural selection actually explains. I mean, when I first looked into this issue, I was perfectly willing to think, oh, maybe natural selection can produce different species or something like that. I'm really myself surprised at just how little it's able to explain, and convinced the only reason that more scientists don't abandon it and say, okay, this explains a little bit, is because it functions as a designer substitute. It's really the metaphysical water that it's carrying that ends up doing most of the work for it.
When I listen to you speak, I oftentimes think about the plasticity of the brain, the fact that the more you know, the more you can know. It's absolutely amazing the breadth of knowledge that you have.
Well, in some ways, I say I'm a shameless generalist, and so I'm really interested in the intersection of issues. I mean, I did theology, and then I ended up specializing in philosophy. And then I wrote a couple of technical books and some technical journals and thought, you know, what I'm really interested in is the intersection of different issues, the intersection between Christian worldview and natural science and climate science and economics. And there aren't a lot of people focusing on that. In the academic world, people tend to stay in their specialty. And so I get seized by different issues. Some academics want to spend 30 years drilling down on a single issue, and that's fine. They end up being the world's expert. I spend time on an issue and feel like, I don't know that I have anything new to contribute to that, so I'm going to study something else. And in fact, Hank, I'm just now finishing up a book on fasting that's got to be turned in to my editor in January. But it's one of these things that started out with me just experimenting with it, and I realized it turns out there's a heck of a lot of data about the physical benefits and, of course, the spiritual benefits of fasting. And mm-hmm. So I joke that the philosophy allows you to be a parasite on the other disciplines.
Well, I'll tell you, that fasting book, I can't wait to read that, because that's become part of my life. And it has been transformational on a lot of different levels. You know, something you said also reminds me of your writing on passion. You're saying that there's a fallacy involved in saying that the best way to succeed is to follow your passion. Interested in having you explain what that fallacy is.
Yes. And in fact, I say this in my new book, The Human Advantage. Even told a bunch of high schoolers that were graduating in a Christian high school, don't follow your passion. And a lot of them, I could tell they were disturbed, but I noticed every parent pulled out his or her smartphone to take notes. And my basic argument is this: we don't tell kids, well, what do you feel like doing? Follow your feelings. You know, that's the ideal guide for you in your decisions in life. In fact, we spend 18 years trying to get kids to use their reason to follow virtue and to have their passions come along after that. Then when it comes to career advice, we say, well, what are you just passionate about? Sometimes people end up being passionate about things that can also allow them to make a living. But I know in my own case, there was a time when I was passionate about cardiology. I wanted to be a heart doctor. And then for years, I was passionate about being an oceanographer, even though I lived at the time 13 hours from the ocean. Thought if I became an oceanographer, I'd swim with the dolphins and live on pods on the bottom of the ocean. I had no idea what was happening. But, you know, when it comes to career advice, really the question is there something I could be good at that would provide something for people that they would want and would pay me to do it? I mean, that's really the question. And in economics and in the world of work, just making a lot of money at something, that's usually not satisfying. What we want to do is we want to be able to be paid to do something in which we create value. And you're not creating value for someone if you're not providing something for them. And so my argument is, look, if you're graduating from high school trying to decide what to do in college, find the overlap between what you might be able to do well, what people want, and what they would be willing to pay you to do. Focus on that. And then very often the passion will follow. I tell this story in the book about this septic tank company owner in Wisconsin named Les Swanson, who is passionate about septic tank solutions, not because he found that intrinsically interesting, but because he found a method to serve people in this way. And then he finds fulfillment in that. So what we want, it's not that you don't want to be passionate about your work. Of course you do. You don't want to spend 30 years doing something that you think is a drag. Just don't expect your fleeting passions and emotional feelings to be an especially good guide in showing you exactly what you ought to do with your life, at least what you ought to do with your life when it comes to a profession.
I think this is one of the great advantages of being a follower of Jesus Christ. Before I committed my life to the Lord, and, you know, in the spiritual gymnasium, receiving the graces whereby I can become by grace what God is by nature. Before that happened, trying to find a career was like trying to find a needle in a haystack. But once you commit your life to the Lord, it seems that He guides you through people and circumstances through a myriad of ways to finding that very thing that He designed you specifically to do.
That's exactly right. Because, of course, and some people, when I first started talking about this, thought I was saying, don't follow your calling or vocation. I'm not saying that at all. What you want to do is be praying and fasting and reading scripture and taking guidance from God. Because the truth of the matter is your feelings and passion that you have initially, that might not be what God wants you to do. Now, God's not going to call you to do something that you're terrible at. He will equip you to do that. But sometimes finding out what God wants you to do, it is a matter of, it's the Christian walk in which, if you'd asked me what I was going to do 30 years ago, I was in an officer candidate program for the Marine Corps. That's what I thought I was going to do. I'd do that for a few years, and then I would, you know, work in politics. That was my plan. Well, God had something else in store for me, and it was only because I was open to that, as opposed to what seemed to make sense to me, that I've ended up doing things that, frankly, are way more exciting. But I would never have imagined doing this 30 years ago. This was not by my design that I ended up in this area. In fact, the stuff I'm doing, I probably didn't know could even be done 30 years ago.
You know, it was really interesting for me is I have always had a passion. And this first thing I thought about, by the way, when you talked about the fallacy of the best way to succeed is to follow your passion, I thought about myself, because one of my passions from the time I was 14 years of age was playing golf. And I wanted to become a golf professional. And I got pretty good at it. But I realized after a while that this could never be my vocation, because as good as I might think I was at it, I was never that step up that you need to be even a journeyman on the PGA Tour. And so I realized that, yeah, it's my passion. But so my passion became my avocation as opposed to my vocation. And it's been a great, great diversion for me. It's a way of getting away. So it's kind of neat. That's my passion, but that's not what I do for a living.
No, and that's the difference between a vocation and an avocation, is that you can still have, in many ways, that's what hobbies are, is hobbies are things that they're fun diversions that we enjoy simply for the sake of doing them. There is nothing wrong with that. The fallacy comes when you say, I want to be able to do what I enjoy, and somebody should pay me to do it. That's the problem. Well, no, the only reason somebody should pay you to do something is because you're providing a good or a service for them that they want. Otherwise, it's just coercion. And so, as in your case, and with playing golf, in my case, it was actually music and singing. I was pretty good at it. I get a lot of enjoyment out of it. It was clear this was never going to be a career. And so, at some point, you want your kids to be mature enough to be able to figure out, okay, this is fun, but this is going to be a hobby. This is going to be a side diversion or an avocation. This isn't going to be the way that I provide for myself and my family.
You call yourself a shameless generalist, but I think there's a sense in which that needs to be parsed out, because I found out in apologetics that for me to write on a popular level, I have to digest that which is given on a scholastic level. So for me to do popular apologetics, I have to understand top apologetics. Otherwise, I end up doing slop apologetics. I think that's the same thing true with respect to what you do. I mean, what you do, I find time and time again, as I read your books, as I listen to you, that you have digested the tough stuff, that you've done the hard work.
Well, that's honestly, I appreciate that, Hank, because I feel like if there's any specific thing I feel called to do, it's this task of translation, because I think there's so many important world-changing ideas that get trapped up in the academic heavens so that they're not down where people can actually make use of them. And so more than anything, what I want to do when I'm writing a book is to say, okay, I want to really have this be founded in the evidence and the most solid arguments, but I want to make the arguments and explain them in a way that an eighth grader could understand. And it's true. I mean, I often don't point this out to my fellow academics, but writing at a popular level in a competent way, it's actually a second-order skill, because you first have to understand the subject, and then you have to say, okay, now how do I translate it? It's like somebody tells you, okay, I want you to make a perfect copy of this amazing painting, but now you can only use 6 pallets to do it. That's a really hard job. This is what makes C.S. Lewis so great. He was an amazing scholar, but he could write in a way that millions of people were drawn in. And that really is. I mean, it is tough because you got to dig into the details, and then you got to figure out how to translate it.
You contributed to The Call of the Cosmos. And as you know, Jay, I'm a huge, huge fan of Illustra Media. I just love their films. I think their films are making a difference beyond anything that they could even imagine. But I was listening to you in The Call of the Cosmos, which, by the way, we make available for those who support the ministry at equip.org. You were talking, I think, if I recall correctly, about solar eclipses. And you wrote about this as well in a book with Guillermo Gonzalez, I believe.
The Privileged Planet.
Privileged
That's
Planet,
exactly
yeah.
Right.
And I find this to be so fascinating. It is a way of communicating God through the book of nature rather than through special revelation, but it is a powerful call. It tells us there has to be a God. Talk about that concept with respect to the idea of a solar eclipse.
Well, a solar eclipse, it happens because of this. You could think of it as a coincidence of several things. You have to have a luminous body like the sun. You have to have an eclipsing body like the moon. You have to have an observer platform, that is, where observers can be. And then you need them all to line up in the same, in a line in space, essentially. And if you get that alignment, then you'll get the eclipsing body, like the moon, passing over the sun. But, of course, there's no reason to assume ahead of time that those things should take up the same space and shape in the sky. So my co-author, Guillermo Gonzalez, in 1999, thought, huh, this is weird that there's this perfect match between the moon and the sun in the sky, even though they're radically different bodies. So he did research and thought, basically studied, okay, what would eclipses look like from the other planets in the solar system that have moons? And what he discovered is that the one place where there are perfect solar eclipses in the solar system is the one place where there are observers to see them. Now, that by itself would just be eerie. But anybody that knows about the so-called habitability conditions for a planet knows that, in fact, the size of the sun in your sky is hugely important to whether you're on a habitable planet or not. One of the most important things you need for a planet with life and liquid water on it is that planet has to be the right distance from its host star. And so when you get that right distance in the so-called circumstellar habitable zone, it's going to fix the size of the sun in your sky. Also, another variable that habitable planet needs is a large, well-placed moon, like our moon. If we didn't have a moon, the tides wouldn't work properly, the Earth would wobble on its axis really erratically and catastrophically. And so the moon plays a very important role in life on Earth. And you take these two independent variables, both of which are needed to allow life on a planet, and then they set up the conditions for perfect solar eclipses. And why does that matter? It matters because perfect solar eclipses are a natural experiment that is set up that allows us to discover things about stars. It allowed us even to verify Einstein's general theory of relativity that we had a very hard time doing. And so this is the first example in the book of what was initially our hypothesis, which is essentially that the conditions for life correlate with the conditions for scientific discovery, or to put it more simply, just that the rare places where life can exist in the universe are also the best places overall for doing science. So observers find themselves in the best places overall for observing. That's what you'd expect if the universe were designed for discovery. It's not what you would expect if we're just the sort of result of this kind of blind process of natural selection and purposeless impersonal forces.
You know, this is probably the subject of another podcast in the future, because I have to confess, I haven't even read the book yet, although I have skimmed it. The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. As I understand it, the overarching myth that you're targeting in that book is the idea that machines are soon going to replace people.
That's exactly it. I mean, I have a friend who read the book, and she didn't know the issue, and she explained it to about 30 people. And she said, well, Jay's argument is essentially that machines aren't going to replace us because we're not machines. That's essentially the argument. So much of this debate about robotics and so-called strong artificial intelligence is really sort of metaphysics and anthropology in disguise. So if you assume that we're just machines made of meat, as Marvin Minsky once said, then you're going to say, well, look, if a blind process produced us as these machine thinking machines, why wouldn't we be able to design machines that literally think like we do? And then, you know, we develop and outfit them with kind of robotic prostheses, and they end up being able to do things far better than we could do. So they don't just sort of enhance our productivity and our labor. They literally replace us. That argument only works if you assume that we're machines, because a machine can replace us only if we ourselves are machines. And if we're something more than machines, then whatever a machine might be able to do to sort of mimic certain activities of ours, it's not going to be able to literally replace us.
It sounds, though, like the theory will catch out, because you hear so many people saying that the physical facts will fix all the facts, and they don't see us as body-soul unities. They don't perceive of a difference between the mind and the brain, for example, and therefore it seems to be easy for them to buy into the myth.
No, that's exactly right, because they don't. I mean, when I was at a conference with a real hardcore neuroscience skeptic who insisted that all of our thoughts are just entirely determined by these chemical states in our brain, not that our mind and brains interact in some complicated way, but that literally your thoughts don't have the ability to cause something to happen in your body. Rather, your thoughts are just sort of spin-offs from some deterministic thing that happens in chemistry. Well, what's extraordinary about that is that that means the theorist is actually denying his own existence. Now, that to me, that's the reduction to the absurd of materialism. If a theory requires you to claim that you don't exist and that your thoughts aren't about something, that's the best possible reason you can have for not believing the theory. What you need as a minimum for a theory of reality is it needs to be able to accommodate your own existence. And this is why I tell people, I say, look, you're better off picking a worldview at random than being a materialist, because the materialist view, that's the one that can't possibly be true, because for it to be true, it would mean there are no persons, there's no free will, there's no agents, thoughts aren't about things, there is no subjective first-person experience. None of this makes sense. And notice you don't even have to presuppose theology, you just have to be willing to do a little introspection to realize, there's something wrong with this materialist account.
One of the reasons that this is going to sell the whole idea of artificial intelligence is because we're very, very good at mining the subjunctive, cultivating the seed of threat buried within each unrealized instance. And therefore, there are all these apocalyptic predictions out there and apocalypse sells.
It does sell. And I mean, the reality is that's the needs of fiction and of science fiction often dictate this. I mean, I understand why every movie about robots and computers has to involve them becoming conscious. Because talk about a boring movie. Who wants to watch a three-hour movie about the ship computer on Star Trek, right? It's like a glorified theory. It would be totally boring. So I get that. I'm a consumer of science fiction as much as the next person. But there is no reason to think that a computer, if we can get it working fast enough, is going to become conscious, than to think that a tractor that we can make big and strong enough is going to become an ox. These are just fundamentally different kinds of things. And one is a machine that we make, one is an organism that we don't have the slightest idea how we would make one of those things. And in many ways, our job when we're talking about this stuff is just getting people to open their eyes, look clearly and carefully at what's actually happening. I mean, if you talk to the practitioners, people like David Ferrucci at IBM, who developed the amazing IBM Watson, which is the machine that beat the two leading champions at Jeopardy. People were talking about, oh, Watson is going to be this conscious genius. And he said, no, that's not what's happening. We give it a lot of data, and it has the statistical algorithms, and it just figures out what answer is most likely to be correct. And we've gotten good at designing it to do that. But there's no thinking. There's no subjective consciousness. That's just not what's happening inside these machines.
Probably getting close to wrapping up the conversation, but I think one of the things that probably bears mentioning before we do is your communication about the key to the future being a human virtue.
That's right. I mean, I think a lot of people, when I first started writing and talking about this question of the future of work in an age of smart machines. In other words, when machines really do a lot of stuff, whether it be farming or working in factories or even driving our Uber cars around, that's going to happen. They're going to have machines doing that stuff. What is it that we're supposed to do? And people worry that everybody's going to have a master's degree in computer engineering. That's not actually true. Yeah, that, no, I'm not saying don't do that. If you get a master's degree in computer engineering, you'll find a job. But the reality is that what we need to do is focus on those things that are most uniquely human. And what makes us human is this reality that we are persons with first-person subjective experience. We can choose to act by an act of the will in a certain way and decide I'm always going to show up on time. You do that enough, you become punctual, it becomes a habit. Keep at it, and the habit works its way back into you, in which you become a person who's punctual. You become, in a sense, more than you were before. That is a unique capacity of intelligent beings like we are. In fact, intelligent embodied beings like we are, to be able to develop those virtues. So my argument is that what we do is let's look at what sort of specifies the information economy? What sets it apart from other economies? Well, it grows exponentially. It's highly disruptive. It's digital. It's hyper-connected, and it's ever more informational. And then you focus on the virtues that will allow you to exploit those features. So in a highly disruptive economy, you want to be courageous and be willing to fail. In a highly exponentially growing economy, you want to be anti-fragile. In other words, you want to be able to benefit from failure. In a world in which you can create digital goods like videos online that don't deplete a resource, there's thousands of ways to supply people with services. So you need to focus on altruism and the ability to provide things that people want, to be able to be other directed. So in other words, when machines are doing a lot of the stuff that they can do, that we could do, but that they can do, and in fact, by specializing, probably do better, that opens up an arena in which we will get to focus on those things that are uniquely human. In many ways, the kind of highly repetitive assembly line factory work of the 20th century. In fact, there were many socialists that complained about this. They said, this is people doing the work of machines. Even Adam Smith said that it's kind of dehumanizing if somebody's just having to do the same thing over and over 8 or 10 hours a day. Those are the kinds of jobs that will disappear, but that's going to create an amazing new opportunities. It's just that we have to adjust ourselves and develop and cultivate the virtues that will allow us to succeed in this new economy.
Why should a Christian put this book in their system of priorities? They got to understand this issue of artificial intelligence, understand the issue of the human advantage and the future of American work in an age of smart machines.
I think it's important, especially for Christians, because this is one of the main challenges to human uniqueness. I mean, I know this stuff seems far-fetched, but if you hear about transhumanism, Ray Kurzweil, this idea that our bodies are just sort of these flawed structures, and that our greatest hope is to create technology that will be so amazing and it will be immortal, and we will be able to upload ourselves to new hardware and leave this mortal coil behind. In many ways, it's a kind of hatred and contempt for the body that God gave us. Christians believe not just in a kind of eternal life, we believe in the resurrection of the body, in which God is not just going to give us this wispy, ghostly experience, he's going to give us spiritual bodies. And so the body is a good thing that is part of what makes us who we are. We are unique spiritual material hybrids. And so in some ways, I consider this strong artificial intelligence and so-called transhumanism as an attack on human uniqueness and human embodiedness. And so even though in some ways, I feel like I'm thinking 5 or 10 years out, but this is something we're going to have to deal with. So you're going to have to deal with it economically, because machines are going to be doing a lot of the jobs we're doing, but it's also going to become a major front in the war and in the attack on human exceptionalism. And I think we'll see that happen in the next 5 or 10 years.
You're one of the few people that I would recommend the book before even reading the book. Now, I have scanned the book, but let me just say this for everybody listening in. That book, available for your support of the ministry, check it out on the web at equip.org. Again, it's called The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines by J.W. Richards. And Jay, you're just amazing, and I love these conversations with you.
Oh, I'm so glad to be with you, Hank. It's really been a pleasure. And I'm just coming off a cold, and so I realized, oh, no, I hope I'm not going to lose my voice because I really want to do this interview. It's just great to spend this time with you.
Well, you sounded great, and again, you're just amazing and deeply appreciated. Truly, Jay, you are impacting the lives of people all over the planet in incredible ways, and for that, I'm grateful just as one of them.
Thanks so much, Hank. It's my pleasure.
And again, you can make a difference with the Hank Unplugged podcast by simply going to iTunes, giving us a 5-star rating. I made good on my promise once again to bring the most interesting, informative, inspirational people on the planet directly to your earbuds. So go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and make sure you share the podcast with people within the sphere of your influence. Again, one of the places you can find all of the podcasts archived, including the previous conversation with Jay Richards, is at equip.org on the web. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of the podcast.